Indeed, I hope here I am. We've had a piece of equipment go kaboom. So, trying to talk to Bill Hickey. Bill, if you're out there, pick a break and call me. Dr. Orrin Pilkey is a James B. Duke Professor of Geology, and he's a director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines, that's PSDS, within the Division of Earth and Ocean Science at Duke University. Currently, PSDS research focuses on beach replenishment and other forms of shoreline stabilization, evaluation of the validity of mathematical models of beach behavior, hazard risk mapping on barrier islands, sedimentary processes on shore faces, migration of hurricane property damage on barriers, and principles of barrier island evolution in Colombia, South America. His research in recent years has been funded by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the National Geographic Society, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the National Science Foundation, wow, as well as a variety of private foundations. He doesn't think much about mathematical modeling, apparently doesn't think a whole lot of the modeling that decided that they will put so much nuclear waste right next to me at Yucca Mountain, where, well, gee, I've heard there's earthquake fault lines at 100. I've heard that there's some water that runs under it that they didn't anticipate, and all kinds of things. So I'm just not really looking forward to that. And it'll be interesting to see what he thinks of the mathematical models that say, put it there. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back. All right. Here comes Dr. Orrin Pilkey. Doctor, welcome to Coast AM.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here.
Now, we've got some equipment problems, so I hope that all hangs in. But I am hearing you. All right. Now, you, to sort of put a cap at the beginning of this, you think a lot, if not most, of the mathematical modeling done on various projects is horse pucky. Is that fair?
Well, that's fairly fair. I there are two kinds of modeling. There's modeling that's where you're expected to be accurate and precise. This is modeling of earth processes, and we just, in my view, we cannot be accurate. There aren't accurate models are not possible with natural processes. However, we can learn a lot, like we have about global change and so forth, using the models in a more qualitative way, where you just look at trends or orders of magnitude or directions and so forth. Now, I think our society is depending very heavily on accurate on what we think are or what we are told are accurate models, and they're just not accurate.
All right, your book is Useless Arithmetic. That's pretty strong stuff. Useless arithmetic, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah,
Okay.
that kind of tells it in a nutshell. That gives our view of the validity of accuracy of accurate of quantitative models. So.
All right, let's begin not with Yucca Mountain, but with global warming. Now, we've all been fed all kinds of information on global warming and what we can expect, how many degrees of warming in such and in so many years we can expect. And you think it's, I take it, you think the models are simply wrong.
Well, I think the mathematical models that are used to predict global change are, I mean, I agree with the general picture that the UN committee is, which is about to come out with a new report next week or two, with their general conclusion that we're going into global warming. Global warming is a fact. We can measure it, and global change is a fact. The problem is just the way you stated it is the when the models say that we're going to go up so many degrees, and the water temperatures are going to go up so many degrees, and temperature and sea level is going to rise so many inches or feet. We have to take those numbers with a grain of salt, a large grain of salt. We can't quantitatively predict, but we can look at these models, and the models have been valuable in telling us that global change is upon us, and we can't ignore it. We've got to do something about it.
Okay. Let me read you what's in the current 5 minute Associated Press news. It says, later this week in Paris, climate scientists will issue a dire forecast for the planet that warns of slowly rising sea levels and higher temperatures. But that may be the sugar-coated version. Early and changeable drafts of their upcoming authoritative report on climate change foresee smaller sea level rises than were projected in 2001. In the last report, many top U.S. scientists reject these rosier numbers. Those calculations don't include the recent and dramatic melt-off of big ice sheets in two crucial locations. Now, I take it all of this forecasting is being done by modeling, right?
That's correct. Modeling is a good way to handle a lot of data, and God knows they've got a lot of data to handle, and you're dealing with a global phenomenon here, a global change. And I agree that the 2001 report was pretty sugar-coated. And for example, very recently, the UN panel there said they expected that more snow would start to accumulate on the Antarctic continent, and as a result of the warming of the oceans, there'd be more evaporation, therefore there'd be more snow.
More snow, yeah.
But just the opposite happened. Recent measurements, all short term, of course, but recent measurements have shown that the Antarctic continent is losing ice, losing snow, losing volume, and the same thing's happening in Greenland. It is melting faster than has been expected or predicted, and so they they've been wrong. These are the two points I think that article talks about where they have been wrong, and all of which indicate that sea level is bound to be rising a lot faster than anticipated, and that it's almost bound to accelerate. But putting it into so this is where models are valuable, where you can and by the way, these modelers, the UN panel are quite honest and quite straightforward, and they evaluate they say these are the problems we have with the model, these are the they give all the bad and the good, and they say we're this is a pretty weak assumption here, and this is a strong assumption here, and this is very different from most mathematical modeling that goes on in our society. These guys really, really worry about their inaccuracies. But that's
okay. So then, if I can interrupt, then the climate modeling they're doing, you feel a little bit better about than some other areas of modeling.
Among the areas of modeling that we looked at in our book, we think that the climate modeling is by far the best, by far the most straightforward. You know, they recognize they have lots of weaknesses and are straightforward about it. I'd be a bit more pessimistic than they are, but it's quite a bit more, in fact, about some of their precise statements. But yes, I consider them to be the best type of modeling among these things that we looked at, these various fields.
Okay, well, then there's a difference between you and, of course, you know, the administration is very anti-global warming, or at least they certainly have been until very recent days. And, of course, what they do is attack the modeling.
Yeah, that's one of the problems is that the models, for example, there's one group out there that is saying that, well, if we don't change our CO2 output within 10 to 12 years, we only have 10 to 12 years to change it and to actually turn things around. Well, you know, they don't know if it's 10 to 12 years. Maybe we can't turn around, or maybe we have 50 years. That's the kind of thing that is being said by some groups, and this makes them vulnerable. I mean, the administration can say, well, that's nonsense, and they're right. You know, about some of these very quantitative and precise pronouncements, but basically the Bush administration, for purely political reasons, is ignoring a major, major phenomenon that's going on globally, and it's much to our we are wasting time. We are wasting time.
There's a commercial that's running on TV right now. You might have seen it. And it shows a guy standing on a train track. You seen that one? There's a train coming, and the voice in the background says something like, and I'm paraphrasing, the climate will change in 30 years. Well, what difference does that make to me? And he stands aside, and behind him is his little girl, and of course it's a train wreck.
Yes. I mean, that's a pretty good analogy. In fact, that's a great analogy. We are, you know, it's really, you know, this is an exciting time for science, for global science, I think. We, in my lifetime, which is, I've been around a while, you know, I've never seen the scientific community so galvanized on any public issue, and I'm very proud of the scientific community on this issue. We are getting out and telling people about this instead of sitting in our offices and with our green eye shades and our computers and arguing amongst each other about little details. We are really getting out there. The scientists are getting out there, and that's good. But we have to be careful of what we take of their modeling, and you know we have to look at their, you know, lift up the flap and look carefully. So.
Okay. Well, it sounds to me as though you are pretty well convinced with the rest of the scientific community, which has pretty much reached a consensus. I mean, 10 years ago, Doctor, people were saying it's horseradish and much worse. Today, it seems as though science has pretty much coalesced behind the facts.
Yeah, that's true. I always shudder a little bit about this because you know, good science is not necessarily done by majority vote, and great scientific breakthroughs are usually done by people who are on the outside, who are not there in the swing of things, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Darwin and others were not in the swing of things, but I think the evidence is so overwhelming here that, I mean, there's still a lot that we have to argue about. We have to understand, for example, how much of this climate change is due to human beings,
right?
And that's not certain yet. So,
although I'm not sure. Although it certainly would impact what we do to mitigate it if we decide that we're part of the problem. However, it may go on no matter what we do. In fact, I believe it will. If you look around the world right now, China and Asia, Eastern Europe, the rest of the world, you know, they want a couple of cars in every garage. Basically, they want what we have, and if they get it, and they're probably going to get it, I don't see how we're going to change anything, do you?
I am completely in complete agreement with you. It looks so hopeless in that sense because, you know, for us to be standing up there and telling the developing world that, hey, you know, you can't use gas and oil like we're using it, you know, that just doesn't wash. And so, you know, so the solution may lie eventually in another kind of technology besides burning a fossil fuel. But no, you're absolutely right. This it's really kind of almost depressing to look at the task before us if we're going to really make a change. Oh, it's just everybody wants to be like us, and we're producing much of the world's carbon dioxide, excess carbon dioxide.
Well, we'll come back to that, Doctor. I'm in a little town called Pahrump, Nevada, in the high desert. I wonder if you know where that is.
Well, I think you're not far from Yucca Mountain, judging from the introduction here. Is that true? I don't know where that town is, no.
No, that's all right. We're about 65 miles to the west of Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And kind of not all that far from Yucca Mountain. So I am very, very, very interested in what you have to say about Yucca Mountain. I'm very concerned about Yucca Mountain and what they're going to put there. And they tell me that we're going to have to be custodians of this very dangerous stuff for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years, and mankind has done nothing for that period of time.
You will be custodians, or Nevada will be custodians for essentially a million years or a little bit more, where that's the time frame over which some of this radioactivity will still be hot. Some of the waste will still be hot, and Yes, you will be the custodian of that. Somebody has to be, our fathers in Washington have decided that that will be the place to go. Unfortunately, It has been our fathers in Washington that have decided this and not the scientific community looking for the very best site. It's been a very political thing. And this of all things in our society is of this kind is totally controlled, is totally involving mathematical models. Hundreds of mathematical models are being used to predict the fate of the waste at Yucca Mountain. But the problem is, it's complex, but the problem is that we scientists 20, 30 years ago, when we got computers that we could sit at our desk and do so much with, we told the bureaucrats that, yes, we can predict what's going to happen 10,000 years into the future. And so the requirement has become, wherever we're going to put that nuclear waste, we must know what's going to happen for the next 10,000 years. Well, that's nonsense. Of course we don't know what's going to happen in the next 10,000 years. What's going to happen to the climate? Are we going to start another ice age? Is there going to be a volcanic eruption? But even worse than that, is the fact that recently the federal court said, "No, we have to move that up to 300,000 to 1 million years. We have to know what's going to happen during the next million years." Now that is so ludicrous. 10,000 years was ludicrous, but a million years, I can't find an adjective to describe it. We're going to go through several ice ages, and the Yucca Mountain will be maybe a tropical rainforest during that time. The groundwater will be right up to the, the federal court may as well have said, we must put all the nuclear waste into the second ring around Saturn or something like that. It was an absolutely impossible requirement. So, do we want to say that the federal courts are made up of idiots, or are we scientists at fault? And I think we scientists have to take some of that blame that we didn't tell them we have convinced people that mathematical modeling can really predict what's going to happen, and therefore go ahead and say a million years, because we have these sophisticated, state-of-the-art mathematical models that can tell us what's going to happen. And of course, I mean, it's just a million years is just indescribably bad, just indescribably impossible. So,
well, Dr. Pilkey, if you don't use mathematical models, what can you use? Is there any way to decide where to put this waste other than what they're doing?
Well, yes, that's a very good question, because what are we going to do? Say, well, let's just hope for the best and throw in the waste. Well, of course, we can do this in a much more qualitative way. In fact, Yucca Mountain, on the surface of things, is quite a good place to be, in the sense that it's not far from where all the atomic testing went on. So there's a lot of already contaminated land. And the drainage, we know this for sure, the drainage of the groundwater and the surface water is not going to go to Las Vegas or to your town. It's going to go basically into Death Valley. Excuse me. So the groundwater is going to be a full 1,000 feet, I think, below where they're going to store the radioactive waste. So, on the surface of things, it's pretty good. But I think that I was fascinated, by the way, in a recent magazine article that interviewed people who are in the area where the groundwater will eventually flow if the repository fails.
Will it fail? Is there any way to take good bets on whether it's actually going to fail and reach the groundwater?
Oh, I think it will. I think there's no question. I think they assume that it will fail someday, and they're hoping that it won't fail for a million years, of course. But I think we should assume that it will fail. In fact, that's another approach to this thing. Assume that it's going to fail. Look at the worst case scenario. Where's that waste going to go? And it's going to go out down a valley, a large valley. And there are people who live there, a few people, but there are now people coming in building nice houses and all that.
Doctor, hold it right there. We're at a break point. We'll be right back. Dan in Clackamas, Oregon, with a really good question, I think. He says, hi, Art. Would you ask Dr. Pilkey to please address the mathematical models used for our daily and 3 to 4 day weather forecasts here in Oregon? At least they're terribly inaccurate. Dan, here too. They call them weather forecasts, but they seem more like weather observations to me. In other words, they look out the window and correct what their model said would happen. Now back to Dr. Pilkey in a moment. Doctor, sorry to cut you off so quickly. I'm not watching the clock. I'm looking at equipment here and absorbed in the material that you and I are talking about.
Hey, no problem.
So, this is kind of interesting. Dan in Oregon talks about the modeling that they use for weather. Now, he's right about that. It seems as often to be wrong as right.
Yeah, that's true. The mathematical modeling used for weather is perhaps in some ways the best kind of modeling there is, and it is inaccurate very often. That's because what we call a persistence time of things that make up the weather is very short, and so you can't usually. You're lucky to get 3 days. sometimes you get 5 days. Sometimes you get less than that. How many of us have failed to bring an umbrella, you know, to work when it rains when you come out? But that's a very important point, that this very good modeling, where they look back all the time, they look back to see if they can't try to improve their prediction. They still can't. They can't be perfect or anywhere close to it. I think the Weather Service is still very valuable to us. But
oh, of course it is. Actually, I'm quite good friends with them. I love reading the detailed discussion that they always put up, and I'm kind of friends with the fellow in Las Vegas. We had a forecast not long ago for 10 to 15 mile an hour winds, and we were getting at the time about 60 miles an hour. And so I called Las Vegas and noted that we were getting 55 and 60 mile an hour gusts. And he said, ooh, no kidding. Let me look into that. And it quickly, of course, changed. So that's what I meant when I said sometimes it seems more like weather observations.
Yes, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair statement. And they of all Earth's surface processes that should be modeled, that we need modeling of, it's the weather. But we still, we get 3 days if we're lucky, and that's it. We need a lot more than 3 days at Yucca Mountain.
All right. Let me again ask this question, because I want to be very clear on it. If modeling is so faulty in some areas, Yucca Mountain as a good example, then, Doctor, what do we use?
Well, we have to simply accept a qualitative world. We have to simply accept that we can't model something, that we can't accurately predict the outcome of most natural processes on Earth. And so we just have to step back, and we're just going to have to live with it that we can't predict these things. So what do we do, for example, at Yucca Mountain, if we can't predict a million years of certainty? What do? Well, we can take another approach what other countries are doing. And that is bury your waste and watch it. See what happens and change as technology changes, change your, we call it adaptive management. You would change things as you go along. See what happens. Is the titanium drip shield that they're going to use at Yucca Mountain, if that starts to deteriorate, well, we got to do something different, And so there are ways, in all these things, there are ways we can plan, we can look at contingencies. What's going to happen if the following things happen, and then say, okay, if A happens, we'll do this. If B happens, we'll do that. So, but it does require us to step back and accept that we live in a qualitative world. We can't predict with accuracy where we're going, in so many things on the Earth's surface.
Well, let's come back to climate for a moment. We can certainly look, as an example, at the North Pole, and we can see that over the last several decades, 40 or 50% of the ice that was there isn't there anymore. That's getting to be a very serious situation. And as the ice melts, it seems to be a process that is accelerating itself because, of course, the water absorbs more heat than the reflective ice with snow on it would. And so the process seems to be speeding up. But again, you think that modeling won't tell us where we're going with that?
Oh, qualitative modeling is going to help us in that a lot. For example, qualitative modeling, just looking at what might happen without giving time on it, without giving volumes, without giving temperatures, we know that big changes I think that you talk about in your book, can happen to the circulation of the ocean, of the Atlantic Ocean, because of the changes that are going on in the Arctic. So, and we know that these things can happen. We know that Europe can become very quickly, in a matter of a few decades, can become much colder. And there are many, many things that could happen. Good things can happen. We can have shipping across. We can forget about the Panama Canal for a lot of our routes and so forth. You know, there are winners and there are losers in all of this. But I do want to point out that it is very important for us to study these things. We need more oceanographic data on what's happening to that meltwater in the Arctic. You're familiar with what might happen to the Gulf Stream. It might be pushed to the south.
And as a matter of fact, for I forget how many days recently, it did exactly that. It suddenly moved south, and that happened to coincide with some terrible, just awful storms in Europe. And I don't know if the two are connected, but I do know that it did for a time sort of begin to drift south and then came back.
Yeah, the horror stories about the cooling of Europe, our potential cooling of Europe, are valid. Boy, it's going to change a lot of things. You know, speaking of that, the in Sweden, they take their nuclear waste and they bury it at more than 1,000-foot depth. And they bury it in water. And the reason they do that, one of the reasons they're doing it, is they assume, the scientists in Sweden assume, and they know that someday the ice ages will come back, and that'll happen before the radioactive waste is dead. And Sweden is going to be covered with ice. And I thought that was very, very long-term thinking. It may not be as long-term as they think, but they assume that Sweden is going to be covered with ice. And any burial of radioactive waste right close to the surface might very well spread the waste all over to the south. So people are thinking in these terms. We know ice ages are going to occur again, with or without the CO2 perhaps, but the additional CO2 that we're putting in. But we're probably greatly increasing the rate of this occurrence, the rate of change.
Okay, well, minus modeling, let's say that you're a scientist, which you are, and you're called in front of Congress or the Senate to testify on what you think is going to happen, whether it's Yucca Mountain, whether it's climate, whether it's AIDS or fisheries, and I know you've got something to say about all of that. How do you go in front of these politicians and say, look, we need X number of dollars and we need to do the following without modeling?
Well, I can point out in most of these things that we need, with more field data, both in AIDS and in fishing and so forth, we need more data and we need more field data. We need more observations in the oceans, in the atmosphere. I wouldn't say to the Congress that we do this without modeling. I would say that we would use modeling to investigate the directions in which things are going, to look at the order of magnitude that changes might occur. So modeling would still be a central part of any investigation as to global change and all these other things. I wouldn't throw out models by any means. But I sure would throw out the quantitative model. We just simply have to accept that, you know, we're not going to be precise. We're not going to be accurate with these projections into the future. That's the big difference, I think.
Okay, well, they certainly need some way to decide how many dollars go where. So, it's a little frustrating. I'm sure it's frustrating to you and to everybody else involved. Have you ever testified as to the relative accuracy or inaccuracy of the modeling that others are using.
Oh, yes, a number of times, especially with regard to beach nourishment, which is becoming a big thing on all of our coasts, where we're pumping up artificial sand to replace sand that's been that's being taken away because of sea level rise. And you know, I'm very critical. These are the bad. This is bad modeling. This is really bad modeling, where they predict how long a nourished beach will last, and that's all part of a cost benefit ratio. We got to have a cost benefit ratio according to the law, and in order to have a cost benefit ratio, you got to have a you got to have an estimate of how long the beach will last when you pump it up. Well, you know, who knows when the next storm will occur? That's how long the beach will last. And you don't know that, obviously.
Right.
And then, but the Corps of Engineers, when confronted with this, says, well, look, we can't go to the Congress and say, we want $12 million plus or minus $5 million to pump up a new beach. So therefore, they say we must come up with an accurate cost benefit, accurate estimate, which you can't do, an accurate prediction of how long a beach will last. Well, that's, you know, the Corps of Engineers or we scientists shouldn't be giving Congress inaccurate numbers. Congress is going to have to live with the facts too, and they're going to have to live with the fact that we can't predict how much a beach is going to cost, and we're just going to have to live with that. And that's true in other fields as well, but that's a particularly obvious one, and one that's rather important here along the coast of the U.S.
Speaking of coasts, here's another one. With the melting that clearly is going on, well, I guess it's clearly going on, certainly at the North Pole, and a lot of glaciers now are beginning to retreat severely. Eventually, particularly if it begins to occur at the South Pole, the Antarctic, it's going to begin to cause sea levels to rise. And as we all know, there's a lot of very valuable, very occupied shoreline, and we've got lots of it in the U.S., and are these people going to be at risk? Modeling says probably they're going to be at risk, and even looking at the world right now says that, I guess. What do you say?
Oh yeah, of course. Well, they're the, you know, active. We don't need modeling to know that sea level rise is creating a huge risk to the world. We have so many coastal cities. And we know now, for example, along the East Coast, well, we have a very good tide gauge in North Carolina on a concrete pier at Duck, North Carolina, and it shows the current sea level rise is about 1.5 feet per century. We know it's less in some places, like in Juneau, Alaska, it's dropping, and in Columbia, South America, on the Pacific Coast, it's rising at 10 feet per century, but in any event, globally, the sea level is rising, and the worst hazard for global change and sea level rise are in the atoll nations, and like in Tahiti and some of the French Polynesian atoll islands. Tahiti isn't an atoll, but some of the other islands, and even worse yet is Bangladesh, where millions of people live within a meter, within several feet of sea level. And in these places, it's not going to be the flooding by the sea level rise. It's going to be the destruction of the fresh water supplies. Long before the land is actually flooded, the fresh water will be gone. The salt water will have intruded into what they're using for their fresh water. And so what are we going to do with these millions of refugees from Bangladesh? It's fascinating. And there is a movement afoot, interestingly enough, by some native communities, even in Alaska and in Siberia and in the atoll nations. They're trying to get together to sue the United States for Western Europe for producing all the CO2 that's causing the crisis on their shoreline. I don't know how far they'll get with that, but it's an interesting little issue that
I guess so. I just read about an island that disappeared. I guess 10,000 people had to move off this island. I'm trying to recall where it was, but there was a story about it, and they had to actually leave the island, and it's going to be the beginning of more of that for a lot of people. So
that's what's happening. There's some atolls near New Guinea called the Carteret atolls, and they have been abandoned. The people have been moved to New Guinea, and then the nation of Tuvalu has made arrangements to move its people gradually.
That's
these are all atoll nations, move them to New Zealand. So, wow. We're looking at big changes in the world.
Doctor, I'm going to ask you for an opinion, and that's all it is. But there's this big argument about whether man's hand is a big part of this or it's just a natural process. I don't think, in terms of our planning, it should matter that much one way or the other, because I don't think anything's going to change. That's my personal opinion. But I'd like to ask yours. Do you think man's hand is an important part of what's going on with the climate?
Yeah, I think it is. But you're right. Your suspicion as to whether we can really pin down how much is would be a point that I would make, that we can't really pin it down how much we are responsible. But what makes me think that we are at least partly responsible is the correspondence of the increasing carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, and that's as measured on Mauna Loa. The longest measurement of atmospheric CO2 is on Mauna Loa, and that increasing CO2 content it just corresponds more or less with the global warming that we're seeing. I mean, it's we see about for example, in sea level rise, we see sea level rise beginning about 1850, the middle part of the 19th century, and that's it more or less corresponds to the increase in CO2 by humans. And so I think that's probably a qualitative indication that we're part of the problem. We're a major part of the problem. And then the question is, you know, what can we do? And I share your pessimism about getting the world to change its fossil fuel habits. But I don't think, because we're pessimistic, and I am, I don't think we shouldn't try. I don't think we should throw up our hands and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should try. We should try.
Well, let's say that you were in charge of trying, looking at what's going on in the world right now, what would you recommend?
Well, if I was king of the world, I would be putting all kinds of resources into looking at alternate sources of energy. You know, everybody knows that there's all kinds of potential sources of energy. One of which,
really?
By the way, enemies. Yeah, right? But one interesting source that you haven't heard too much about is energy from within the Earth. And it's been suggested that we could be drilling at the mid-ocean ridges and getting huge amounts of energy where the hot magma is very close to the surface, and we could be producing steam that could go all over the world. I think that's a little ways away, but I find that to be a fascinating possibility. I think I would be, if I was king, I would be funding all kinds of research into other ways of driving around, other ways of transport, get us out of fossil fuel.
And I take it you believe the only reason we're not along that path right now is probably political.
Oh, of course. Politics. Unfortunately, politics is behind this. And unfortunately, we, the nation that is producing most of the CO2 in the world, excess CO2, or a good part of it, we're the nation that's dragging our feet. And I think that's really a shame. I wish we could change that. If I was king, I would change it.
And if you were king, we have another problem that's going on. It's out of your area of expertise, or maybe it isn't. But I keep getting these stories, Doctor, on these dead areas in the ocean. We're having more and more of these areas of the ocean that are virtually devoid of all life. You've heard about those?
Yeah, well, there are, you know, the Mediterranean is changing dramatically, and then we have the dead area in the Gulf of Mexico off the Mississippi River, and these are very important in terms of our fisheries, in terms of the future of our fisheries. And
there was actually a story saying that in 50 years, if we don't change, there's going to be no more fish left. No more fish left. I couldn't believe it, but it was a legitimate story. Ran on the wire services not long ago. This time I'm watching, Doctor. We're at a break point. We'll comment on that when we get back. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell.